Hi, I'm Femi Oke. Today on the stream, we are going to be looking at the climate crisis through the lens of photographers who have been documenting the causes and consequences of our changing climate. Is it possible that one powerful picture or several powerful pictures could change the way we think about climate action? Stand by for a striking show and tell discussion. We start with the extreme photographer, Camille Seaman.
My job as an artist is to create greater empathy and understanding. My job is to help to facilitate a connection or the beginning of a relationship with our environment. Science sometimes is very challenged to create an emotional connection to the subject, to the data. And that's what art is so good at doing. It's so good at reaching that emotive place, that intangible feeling and understanding in a way that data just can't do.
All the photographers that you see on today's show are featured in an exhibition called Coal and Ice. It's a traveling exhibition. It's been around the world now in its 11th year, and it opens in Washington, D.C. this week. Hello, Ian. Hello, Cameron. Hello, Meredith. So good to have all of you here on the stream with us. Cameron, please introduce yourself to our stream audience.
My name is Cameron Davidson. I'm an aerial and location photographer, and I live in Alexandria, Virginia.
Good to have you. Hello, Ian. Welcome to the stream. Please introduce yourself.
Hi, I'm Ian Tay. I'm a documentary photographer, and I'm based in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia.
Nice to see you. And hello, Meredith. Welcome to the stream.
Hi, everyone. My name is Meredith Cohut, and I'm a photojournalist from Texas, and I've spent the past decade documenting humanitarian crises in Latin America.
So, audience, you are in for a treat when you see these photographers' work. If you have questions for them or comments about the power of photography when we're talking about the climate crisis, on YouTube, the comment section is right here. Be part of today's show. All right, guess my biggest issue with climate crisis or climate action and photography is how on earth do you show it? Cameron, how do you do it?
It's subtle, but it depends on what it is. Yeah. If it's something like a flood or a hurricane or wildfires, it's easier. If it's something like rising seas, it's very, very subtle and it's not as easy to show. You can use time lapse, you can use video, and you can use photographs taken over a period of time to show it, but to actually do it in one photograph is pretty difficult.
Ian?
Yeah, I mean, I find, like, when I was working in China and working on the coal industry, it was such a visual subject that, you know, everything came out almost naturally. But in my later projects, I'm trying to make the intangible tangible. So I use captions. I try to give this sense of loss or at least make it people realize the bigger picture through the use of text as well as the images that they're looking at.
Meredith, is it a really hard subject to capture in a picture or in a series of pictures? I know you've been on assignment for the New York Times on several occasions, and where the assignment is climate migrants, climate change, go take pictures. Are you thinking, what the?
My project that's in the Coal and Ice exhibit documents climate migrants all over Central America, through Mexico, and the southern United States. And when my editors first gave me this assignment, I was like, oh my gosh, how am I going to photograph this? I've photographed migrants years since the child migrant surge in 2014. But when I actually started going down into Central America and out to these remote indigenous villages, there were, I mean, acres and acres and valleys of crops that were all just decimated. One of the most visual things that I saw were in this indigenous community in Banzo, and they had planted this harvest of maize. And the crops had grown, but the corn had grown, but with no kernels on it. And that's a staple crop there. And they started to have to leave their community because it had been, you know, failed harvest after failed harvest. And they can't eat, you know, corn that doesn't have kernels on them.
Just going to go through here. Tell us who we're seeing in this picture, Meredith.
That was actually in the same village. You can see the stream behind it. Before that was a river. And, you know, this is an indigenous community. They get all of their water for all their cooking, for drinking, for, you know, anything that we use water for comes from that stream. And every year it's getting smaller and smaller.
One more. This is a picture that, this is a scene that we've seen on the news before. And can you connect it to climate migrants for us?
Yeah, absolutely. So that is a train, infamously known as La Bestia. It's a train that runs through southern Mexico, and that is going through, like, Chiapas, I think. And basically, when I rode the train through southern Mexico, you know, you talk to the migrants and you ask them, why are you traveling? Because it's a really perilous, dangerous journey. And they said, you know, I lost my crops, or, you know, my crops were flooded, and it was super easy to find people, actually, who said that they were having to leave because they can no longer feed their families because of climate-related issues.
Did you feel pain when you were taking those pictures? Did you get the pain of the people in those pictures? Was this a disaster for them? Or was it just another thing that was happening that meant that they had to keep moving, Meredith?
You know, no one wanted to leave. Every single person that I talked to that said that they are migrating because of climate-related issues, they said, you know, it's literally, like, because to keep my family alive. You know, a lot of people in rural areas in Central America, they're subsistence farmers. They feed their families and their communities based on what they grow. And when those crops, you know, aren't edible anymore, they have to move and they have to find work otherwise in other places, because that's literally how they feed their kids.
There's a tweet here that's come from Tammy. Cameron, I'm going to bring you into this one. On my laptop, Tammy says, pictures are the undeniable truth to what is happening across the world. The world has realised that news stations, other than Al Jazeera, thank you, parentheses, often create a narrative set by governments with agendas. So seeing for ourselves what is happening to our planet is imperative for our need to act now. What do you think about the way Tammy sees photographs as being truth?
I think there's so much that goes into a story that, you know, captions can be changed. Captions, I think of, like, one story I did on mountaintop removal in southern West Virginia. And the writer asked me, how can you take such beautiful pictures of such desolation? And I think it's really hard, because it really depends on the slant of the magazine you're working for and the editors and the caption writers, because sometimes it can be interpreted a lot of different ways. So I can't answer that about the government. I can only say how I shoot my stuff and my captions are truthful, and how it's interpreted. Or
a new story could be created out of your photographs.
Absolutely.
Ian, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I find there's so many layers to it in what you're covering, that even as a photographer, I was finding that myself, my views of what I was looking at was growing and changing as I was working on it. So I think when you're actually looking at a specific story, you could actually look at what's going on there. But when you pull back, there's all the political and larger global issues that connect to it. So as a photographer, I guess what I'm looking for is to try and guide the viewer through what's going on the ground, and to try and put it in perspective in the larger context. And in my case, with these pictures in China, you know, China was developing at such a meteoric pace that I was always wondering, you know, what was the actual cost, where, you know, at the very source of how they were developing at that pace. So, you know, they were using things like coal and cheap labor. The country was in a real hurry to try and develop, but there was a price to pay for all of that. And my question when I was working on the story was, you know, what was that cost?
Let me show some more of the pictures. I've got some here on my laptop. Will you talk me through these, please, Ian? What are we seeing? It almost looks like the 19th century here with these coal pictures, but it wasn't. It was much more recent than that. Talk us through.
Yeah, so I was working on this back in 2007, just before the Beijing Olympics. And I was, you know, China had just been, you know, surpassed the US as the first country, you know, the largest producer in carbon emissions. Mm-hmm. And I started going to, you know, to work on the coal industry. So I was going to coal mines. That's a coking plant that you're looking at there. Workers were basically firing up coal to actually produce coke, which is used in the process of making steel. So you'll have these huge industrial complexes where you'd have providing electrical power through coal power stations, so that these were workers who were coming back from an evening. You've got a cooling tower in the background. There's in the north of China, they, you know, that's an electrical plant, and right next to it's a coal power, a steel power plant. So all of these industrial complexes were part of the whole system that was, you know, helping the country grow and, you know, lift people out of poverty at that time.
Cameron, you took pictures of coal mining in West Virginia, and you're from a coal mining family.
Yes.
So then that becomes personal.
Yes, very much so. Yeah. It was my great-grandfather was the chief of Bureau of Mines, and then all my great uncles were coal miners. And, you know, I've never been in a mine. I just, there's no way.
Cameron, you're letting the family tradition down.
Yeah, but shooting it from the air, you know, with longwall mining or basically mountaintop removal, where they remove the complete top of the mountain and then that overburden is tumbled into a stream or the watershed. So for me, I wanted to show that. I wanted to show these beautiful mountains in southern West Virginia with the tops cleaved off, and to show what that looked like and how it impacted communities and how it just impacted the earth. And it's pretty nasty stuff.
It's brutal.
Yeah,
it's
it is.
Hacking the landscape, hacking our environment.
Some of it's been reused. I mean, sometimes they'll build housing or redo the fields, but most of it just lays fallow, and there's always seepage and problems with it, particularly water pollution.
I want to add another voice to our conversation. This is Nicole Sobrecki. What occurred to me, Meredith and Ian and Cameron, from what you're saying is that often you're bringing stories to the public that they wouldn't necessarily know or see if you hadn't been there to take your photographs. And this is the case with Nicole, who does a lot of her work on the African continent. She spoke to us a couple of days ago. Here she is.
Somalia is one of the countries on this planet hardest hit by the climate crisis. It's also contributed less than 0.01% to global carbon emissions. What we're seeing play out there is a new breed of international crises, where the hazards of war are meeting the hazards of climate change, leading to a negative feedback loop that's punishing some of the world's most vulnerable people and really breaking down their country's ability to be resilient. I'm driven to tell these stories of people striving and sometimes struggling to adapt to a rapidly changing environment in the hopes of raising an alarm. The extent of climate harm depends collectively on all of us. And in my opinion, it's the greatest threat that we face.
Yes, I have a question in from Al Hussein, who is watching right now on YouTube. And he asks, how do you think changes in technology have influenced the awareness of climate photographs or climate crisis photographs? The tech, how's the tech helped you, Meredith, if at all?
I think mostly, I mean, the main project that I worked on that's in the exhibit was part of a modeling that took years with the New York Times Magazine, ProPublica, and the Pulitzer Center. And this whole project came from their ability to, you know, track and start to model and predict the amount of people that are going to be migrating over the next few decades. And what they found was astonishing. Millions of people are going to be displaced between now and the next few decades.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So you're basically putting a picture to the data so the data makes sense, it's accessible. Cameron, I'm just thinking about technology, how that helps you take your pictures better. I know now you've gone from flying to to drones.
Yes.
That's different.
Well, it's safer, which is, you know, I've spent too many years in helicopters. Yeah. The nice thing about drones is you can keep going back to the same place over and over, and you're shooting lower. You're, you know, shooting no higher than 400 feet, and so you get a little bit more intimate view than you would if you were shooting from a helicopter, say, at 500 or 1,000 feet. That, and plus just being able to distribute pictures makes it so much easier. You know, there's things like YouTube and Instagram and Twitter and all that, so it makes it a lot easier to show the work.
I'm really glad you said Instagram, because I'm on, Ian, your Instagram account here, where you're talking about coal and ice and how it has evolved over the last 11 years. And this idea of grabbing the public with the images, that's one area of tech that I hadn't even thought about, that the social media platforms, you're all on social media, you're all on Instagram, you all have websites. I mean, that must be a dream for you if you're trying to get your pictures out there, particularly when you're talking about something like climate action or climate change. Ian?
Yeah, I think when I started working on this project, I was actually shooting on film, and, you know, my work had to be published in magazines to be seen, or I'd have to have an exhibition. But social media has actually allowed me to actually keep these issues and this work alive, you know, the issues that I was covering at that time. Mm-hmm. So it's been incredible for that, and it's made me kind of allowed me to reflect more and more about, you know, what all of this means, especially when this work was shot, you know, some 10 years ago.
It also must mean that the public are coming to you and talking to you about those images. What are those conversations like, Ian?
It's evolved over time. I mean, when I've had shows, etc., in the past, it was more about highlighting an issue at that time, because it was probably less well known as it is now. I think now it's more a confirmation of what's going on, and, you know, more questions arise about, you know, how are we going to handle this as a planet.
I'm going to bring in one more additional photographer. His name is Gideon Mendel. He's a photographer and artist, and he talks about the power of his work. Have a listen, have a look.
Since 2007, I've been documenting both flood and fire, and working in not a conventional documentary manner. I think my work functions as both evidence and metaphor. Significantly for me, it's been part of activism, used in many protests and many actions by organizations like Extinction Rebellion and Greenpeace. At this moment in our history, when it's so clear that our climate is turning and creating dangerous circumstances, destroying houses, destroying landscape, destroying communities around the world, it's so important to make work that shows our shared vulnerability to this.
Cameron, when you ask a lot of photographers, what is the most memorable photograph or shoot or series of photographs you've ever taken, most of them will just sit and be stumped. And you said, without a pause, the Great Mississippi River Flood.
Yes.
Why?
Well, I had gone on vacation to California after calling the magazine I was shooting for. And then they said, oh, no, can you come back?
How long did that vacation last?
4 hours. So I went from LAX to St. Louis and had some of my equipment shipped to me. And I started shooting. The first day was hard because we got up in the helicopter, and it was probably well over 10 miles that the Mississippi River was from shoreline to shoreline. So that was in shock. And I went from St. Louis to Des Moines the first day. I spent like 9 hours in the helicopter.
Is it obvious what you need to shoot in that situation? I mean, this is like a 1,000-year flood.
Yes. Well, there's many things. I mean, it's targets of opportunity, things that you just see, like, you know, unfortunate things like a deer swimming in the middle of the river to a tree, and the tree is underwater, you know, to flooded houses, to farms awash.
Got some pictures here on Instagram, because you post a little archive knowing that you're going to talk about this.
Yes.
Let's have a look here. Talk us through what we're seeing here.
That was the third week of the flood that I was shooting, and I shot that with a special panoramic camera. you shoot four frames, then you have to spend more time reloading. That was a farmhouse in the north of Missouri near the Iowa border. This is along the Missouri River. It's a small airport in St. Charles County. And that was underwater. I don't recall the name of it. But, you know, the key is you find pilots that know how to fly for the camera, and you work very much work as a team.
Yeah. And why was that? Was it because your vacation was interrupted that you remembered it, or because the images were so startling?
Oh, no, because it was so overwhelming. The first day I was in shock.
Yeah.
And then you knuckle down and you start working.
I'm wondering about how close you get to a risky situation and danger. For instance, Meredith, I know you've shot wildfires before, and you actually have technical advice. You get people who come on and advise you about what you do, where you go, you're wearing PPE. How do you shoot in those kind of circumstances?
Well, the best way to photograph a wildfire is usually at night. So you're sleeping during the day, and you go out as soon as it gets dark and keep shooting until, sometimes 2, 3, 4 in the morning. And usually shooting with a tripod, and you get as close to the fire line as possible. And especially like that photograph, for this project, we really wanted to show the urgency of climate change and how it was getting so close to people and their homes. And that's a fire in Azusa, California. And yeah, it really
what's
that
falling
close,
so. What's are you hot? Is there ash falling down on you? And what are you thinking as that's happening? Are you so in the moment you're just taking the picture?
Oh no, for that photo, I sat on the side of a culvert for about 6 hours just photographing the same photograph over and over again, waiting for that fire to kind of get closer to the community. But there's other times when you're like racing into the fire line and just jumping out and trying to get a few photos and then jumping back in the truck and speeding out because, you know, there's so much smoke and so much ash and trees are falling.
Meredith, as you're saying that,
get out of there.
Ian's nodding his head like, what the what? Ian, articulate that shaking your head. Go ahead.
Well, I mean, yeah, it just seems like a crazy situation to be in. And I imagine like without kind of any proper safety advice, I wouldn't know how you'd actually, I wonder how you'd actually operate inside there. I mean, just the logistics wise.
All right, I'm sitting next to Cameron. I've got this picture here of which looks like a wildfire. So then I would just say, pro tip, get in a plane or use a drone, right?
Well, yeah, this was a helicopter.
Right.
And this was a Snake River fire in northern Idaho. And we had stopped and got connections with the fire marshal from the Forest Service, and they gave us all sorts of information. And we had to check in every 5 minutes, and we had fire suits with this because if we had to auto-rotate, they had to know where we were or close to where we were. It was interesting photographing that particular shot because that erupted again, and the heat actually drew us in because it's sucking so much oxygen.
Oof.
Helicopter pilot had to give a lot of power and left pedal for us to get out of there.
Are there moments where you just am I going to make this?
There's been times, yeah. Not many. I tend to fly with really good people. But there's always mechanicals, and that's why I like drones.
Are those photographs worth the risk, worth the danger? Do you look at the picture and go, it's worth it because I told a story that day?
Yes.
Yeah. Meredith?
Absolutely. It's absolutely worth
Ian's stroking his chin. I'm wondering how much danger Ian gets into. Ian's like, you too, you're crazy. But it takes all types and all types of photographers. Thank you so much for sharing your work with us. And just the images alone say so much of a story that we can't necessarily get over when we talk about climate crisis and carbon emissions, etc. Let me show you how you can see more of the work of Meredith and Ian and Cameron and many other photographers. Coal and Ice is an exhibition at the JFK Center for Performing Arts with the Asia Society. It's on from March the 15th through April the 22nd. If you're in the DC area, you can see it there. Meredith, Ian, Cameron, I salute you. Thank you very much.